right. The clerk will call the next case, please, if y'all are ready.
The court will now call Justin Michael Love versus the State of Texas. May I please the court? Melvin K. Moraney will argue for the appellant. Bryce Perry will argue for the state.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, justices. I'm Melvin Terraney, and I'm here on behalf of Justin Love, who's the appellant in this case. Now, Mr. Love was convicted of the first-degree felony offense of engaging in organized criminal activity with an underlying offense of murder. We're here today with I briefed three issues, but I think I'm going to focus a lot on the first issue, and it touches on the right to choose the counsel of one's choice, which the United States Supreme Court regards as the root meaning of the constitutional guarantee of the Sixth Amendment. In this case, the trial court erred by disqualifying Mr. Love's retained trial counsel based on a conflict of interest between Love and his counsel under Texas Disciplinary Rule of Professional Conduct 3.08. This purported conflict arose because Barber, Love's attorney, Mark Barber, and I refer to him as Barber, he allowed Love's wife, Tamlin Love, to take a CD containing the state's discovery material provided under Code of Criminal Procedure 39.14. He allowed her to take that material and look at it. At the time, she was, she was married to Mr. Love, and she would end up becoming a key witness for the state. At this time, for all intents and purposes, Mr. Barber thought she was just his spouse and she was a witness, and so...
Cool. Counsel, let me ask you, if Mr. Barber had redacted the identifying information that's called for under 39.14 and given Ms. Love the disc, would that have made a difference, do you think?
I don't know. I don't think that it necessarily would have. I mean, if you read the statute, it says not to give it to them, but it does say that it was redacted or that it should be redacted before you let them see it. Obviously, on the record, there is some discussion of that where Mr. Barber explains that, and it's kind of a back and forth between him when he's questioning one of the state's investigators and says, look, you guys normally redact the stuff you give us, so he probably was... At least from that, it sounds like he was under the impression it was redacted.
Well, the prohibition's actually against giving originals, is it not? The prohibition itself doesn't say anything about counsel not being able to give to... It specifically prohibits giving documents.
Yes.
It's materials, etc. Doesn't specifically prohibit giving copies until the second provision... where it says, if you do give copies, then you must redact from those copies.
Yes. Okay.
So was the disc that was actually provided to Mr. Barber considered to be a copy, or was it considered to be originals under the first provision?
And Mr. Barber interpreted the rule to be that as long as he didn't create his own copy of that disc, so at least for the purposes of that hearing, I think he took the position that was the original, I guess you might say, or the original provided copy. I don't know if there's a official thing for that, but he felt that providing it to her and just not allowing her to keep it or making a copy and then giving that straight away to her, he felt he was within the bounds of the law by doing that. Well, in the course of some jail conversations, an investigator for the district attorney heard some conversations between Tamlin and Love, and in one of those conversations, that's where Tamlin mentioned that that Barber had allowed her to take the disc to look at. Now, she went on to tell Love about some of the witnesses, who they were, and Mr. Love made some statements that were incriminating about, you know, dissuading the witnesses from cooperating.
Well, is it true, though, that, I mean, let's say that, Mr. Barber had done what I believe the state is suggesting he should have done, which is let Ms. Love sit in a conference room and look at the materials. She could have then gone to the jail, or Mr. Love could have called her, and she could have relayed the same information about who the witnesses were, and he could have said, very well said the same thing, like, tell them to go to Colorado, right?
Yes, exactly.
So I'm having trouble with the disconnect from the state's argument between between why it matters that she said to her husband, you know, Barbara gave me this and it's highly not allowed, or whatever he was alleged to have said, and the substance of what she conveyed to her husband.
There would only be a nexus if there was some evidence that Barbara intended to do more, and there was some evidence that Barbara was a part of some conspiracy to dissuade witnesses, which there was never anyone that ever came forward and said, I was dissuaded from testifying. As a matter of fact, from the time of the jail calls that were the problem here, I mean, it was early February of 2016. They don't even have a disqualification motion until May of 2017. You have nearly a year and a half. And if I'm not mistaken, on the record, it'll show that there was a co-defendant tried.
Right, in November of 2016.
Yes, there had been a co-defendant with the exact same facts, the same witnesses. This was the individual who actually shot the man in question, the victim in the case. And in that whole time, at no point did anyone ever come forward and say, you know, Mr. Barber approached us and tried to arrange some secret thing. Nothing like that had occurred. So there is a disconnect between the act of arguably breaking that rule and giving her the disc, and then Mr. Love's conduct afterwards. You know, and so the trial court found that Barber's mentioning there, and that all of that would have rendered him what the court termed a likely witness. And of course, it based this on Rule 0.308, and the court did cite the case of Gonzales v. State, which I think is an important case for our purposes, because it was a case where the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals kind of put together, they didn't do a systematic framework, but they tied in some things that were out there about the law, about, you know, how much speculation do we do when we look at these things. The unsworn witness aspect, or unsworn witness rule. I kind of call it an unsworn witness problem more than I'd call it a rule. I think you hear it called a rule. And so our contention is that, you know, the ruling was an error because Barber simply wasn't a witness necessary to establish any essential fact on behalf of his client, as Rule 3.08, in its just in plain language, it asks that that's a requirement. That's a predicate before you get to whether or not the state was prejudiced. Before you look at any of that, you have to say, okay, well, was he a necessary witness? And you start to ask, well, what would they need? If they want to put on evidence that Mr. Love engaged in wrongdoing, that he made those incriminating statements, well, they can play those statements, and they speak for themselves. You don't really have to know anything about what happened in discovery to hear him say, oh, so-and-so's come and tell him not to, or put him in call, send him to Colorado, that, you know, the gist of what he said.
Let me ask you one quick question, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. The
state provided notice of the potential violation under 39.14 in October of 2016, and it didn't file its motion until May of 2017. Did Mr. Barber do anything between October and May to rebut this proactively, or just let it lie there?
I mean, my understanding is he let it lie there in terms of that. I believe at some point there was a change of venue hearing.
Where he brought up all the publicity about the states having filed this.
Once they had filed, but I think that may have been even after they filed the motion to disqualify. So I don't know of anything on the record that would show Mr. Barber doing something to try to prove he didn't engage in some kind of witness tampering or that sort of a thing.
But there's also, I mean, there's a fact question here about, not a fact question. She said, I'm not supposed to give you this. He said, Barber says, no, it was fine. Wasn't that a potential issue that was going to come up at trial when this was played, how the state, how she obtained the file, whether she was authorized to show the file to anyone, whether it was prohibited, and wouldn't Barber be a potential witness on that issue?
Well, again, I kind of get back to whether or not that would be necessary for anything in the case. I mean, if she was entitled, I guess I should go back and also point out that Tamlin was entitled to know who the witnesses were. She's a key witness. She had, and it was also came out on the record that the witnesses were all public record. So her way, like I take, I guess my point on that is that I think it wouldn't have been a big issue as to why she knew who these people were in the first place is what I'm thinking. I mean, she was an active participant in the marijuana sale that led to the murder. She was involved. She knew everybody who had gone to the scene of the murder. She didn't witness the murder, but she was there when they came back after the murder and saw them helped. There was some question maybe she helped or was involved in disposing of the murder weapon. So I don't, and the jury would have heard all of that and did hear all of that. So I don't know that there is even a real reason to jump in and start digging in the weeds about how discovery works and all of that. I don't know if that's answering your question, Justice.
Your client was not ever, I'm just looking at part of the Gonzalez opinion where it says that at the time the trial court judge in that case made the disqualification ruling, the allegations of witness tampering were still a viable part of the case.
Yes.
Now, were there ever any charges brought against Mr. Love or against Mrs. Love for witness tampering?
No, Your Honor, there were none.
So the disqualification occurred and then the trial occurred. Was there anything in the trial itself that could be a reference to the transaction between Barber and Tamlin?
In the actual,
in other words, cross-examining Tamlin, direct examination of Tamlin, any reference to anything that was in the file that brought up the issue of how the file was obtained and how Tamlin obtained the file?
I believe the only thing that came about in her testimony was that they did ask her if she was asked to dissuade witnesses by, you know, Mr. Love, in which she said yes. But other than that, I don't believe that any of it ever came up as an issue in the actual trial. Now, I think the Gonzalez opinion kind of makes it clear to where I don't know if that's part of the analysis or not, if we go and can look at that. It's the opinion seems to maybe foreclose that.
The state never called Barber.
No.
Okay.
No.
And the state never asked any questions of Tamlin with regard to how she came into possession of the file.
No. And in the, I do think it's relevant what happened in the co-defendant's trial, because and it was on the record that in the co-defendant's trial, they just agreed not to talk about it. I mean, that's what they did. And at the time that this conversation between Mr. Love and his wife was going on, the allegations and things were all coming down on Mr. Brooks, who was the actual man who pulled the trigger. And so it would have, any witness intimidation would have been to his benefit as well. And none of that was brought up at that time. And I do think that's something to look at, because if this was such a critical issue and we got to get to the bottom of it, it wasn't necessary for that case. And again, there's just no other allegations ever surfaced about him, about Mr. Barber. It wasn't like Gonzalez, where you had this very detailed interaction between the lawyer and a witness and the defendant, and there's this big ongoing dispute between the witness and the lawyer about exactly what their interaction was about, and now the jury is put in this very difficult position where they've got to figure out who's telling the truth here, the lawyer or the witness. That's not present in this case. This case is just simply outside the scope of that opinion. There's just not if anything, if you could say, well, maybe it's arguable Mr. Barber could be a witness, it's tangential to the case. It's just again, if the state wants to harp or hammer on Love for his wrongdoing or his statements that are bad, they can play those statements. They did play those statements. And so I just think the contrast with this case and even the other cases cited in the Gonzalez opinion, it's hard to find how Barber is in a worse position than, say, the lawyer in the Harrison v. State case that is cited in Gonzalez. It's a black eye case, and I may not have time to get into the details on that case, but that's a case that the lawyer had personal knowledge of an issue with the witness on the witness stand who, you know, and arguably it had a lot to do with the guilt or innocence of his client, you know, and so that it was a case where the lawyer had seen, observed a police officer and said, hey, you didn't have a black eye earlier when I saw you, and of course the police officer and him got into it over that a little bit, but.
Thank you, counsel, yes, your time's up. Thank you.
Justice.
Counsel?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Bryce Perry and I represent the state of Texas. The principal issue in this appeal is whether the trial court abused its discretion by disqualifying appellant Justin Love's retained counsel, Mark Barber. Throughout the proceedings in the trial court and during later mandamus proceedings in this court, the state moved for Barber's disqualification on two independent and distinct theories that are each grounded in the orderly and fair administration of justice. In this appeal, appellant challenges only one of those two grounds, contending that the trial court erred by granting disqualification under Rule 3.08 of the Texas Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct. That's the attorney as a material witness.
Well, counsel, let me ask you, and I can't think of a hypothetical where this would be the case, but 3.08 dealing with the lawyer as witness, obviously the appellant has taken his challenge head on. Does the state have standing? Let's just say this is a run-of-the-mill conflict between defense counsel and his client, and there's not a possibility that there's anything that defense counsel is going to be testifying about. Does the state have standing, I guess, for lack of a better word, to try to disqualify chosen counsel?
Your Honor, I don't know the issue in terms of standing. What I do know is that in the Gonzalez opinion from the Court of Criminal Appeals, the court addressed a trial court's sua sponte ability to disqualify counsel under Sixth Amendment grounds when the court learns of information that would show that counsel has a material conflict with his client. In other words, the court has the right to step in sua sponte and disqualify counsel if the court finds that counsel would not be able to, because of a conflict of interest, provide robust representation to his client.
Okay. Well, I'm struggling to understand what essential facts Mr. Barber would have testified to. I mean, I really see a disconnect between what he did, that let's take as a given that was a violation of 39.14, and what actually happened, because Mr. Love and Mrs. Love both knew who the witnesses were going to be. It was certainly no secret. And what did she tell him that she couldn't have learned from a redacted copy of the file that she had a right to sit and look at in his lawyer's office?
Your Honor, my answer to that question would be in two prongs. And the answer is the illegality of her possession and use of the file was a critical fact that there was a dispute between Mr. Barber and Tamlin about. And the reason that the illegality was a critical fact was for two reasons. And the first one of those is that in a recorded December 2016 jail call between Tamlin and her husband Love, at which time she had agreed to testify against him, and he knew that. She had entered a plea bargain in a related case and had agreed to testify against him. He made the representation to her that he knew that she had illegally possessed this file and had illegally discussed it with others, and he said, I'll be asking you about that at trial. And so his representation in that recorded jail call was that he was going to make an issue of this when it came to trial. And I think the trial court could have simply taken him at his word to say that this issue of not only her possession of the file, but the fact that it was illegal would arise at trial because a reasonable defense attorney would ask Tamlin, who had reviewed the file, would ask Daphne Seltzer, who Tamlin had discussed the file with, about their illegal joint review of that file together as a means of cross-examining their testimony.
But both Ms. Seltzer and Ms. Love had a perfect right to review the file in Mr. Barber's office, correct?
What they did not, they had a right to review portions of the file. What they did not have a right to do was to review unredacted information within the file or to have any copies of the file. And I know that that question was asked in the appellant's argument. I would cite this court to the Powell versus Hawker case, and the cite for that is not in the state's brief, but it's 516 Southwest 3rd, 488, and it's on page 495. It's a Court of Criminal Appeals opinion from 2017 that addresses this very matter of could a defendant himself, in that case it was the defendant himself, not a material witness, is the defendant himself entitled to copies of the file, unredacted or redacted? And the court in that case said that the defendant himself is not entitled to those copies. So certainly, if the defendant is not, then a material witness is not either.
Of course, Mr. Barber had told Ms. Love, don't make a copy, right? I mean, that could have been incredibly naive and stupid, but that's what he told her. It's not like he gave her a copy, right?
He gave her the disk itself, which I think is reasonably construed as giving her a copy of all of those materials. It's an electronic form of all of the materials that are on the disk.
She downloaded it onto her own computer, so she actually made the copy.
And that leads me to another point, which was that the second reason that I think the illegality was a critical fact in this case was because it relayed to the consciousness of guilt issue. Both parties had compelling reasons to make an issue of the illegality at trial. I've already talked about why Mr. Love had promised to make an issue of that, but the state had a reason to make an issue of that too.
Was the argument that Mr. Love was telling her that he would impeach her with her illegality and therefore she should do X, Y, or Z?
That's exactly what he said to her in that recorded call, and that's on volume 22, page 76 of the reporter's
record. Of course, did she do something illegal, or was it Mr. Barber who did something illegal?
It was Love, through his counsel, that did something illegal. And the reason the state had a compelling reason to bring out not only her possession of the file, but the fact of her knowledge of its illegality is because in the consciousness of guilt question, when, of course, the reading of the file and its contents led to Mr. Love realizing he was going to lose, and then he instructed her to go hide witnesses. But his knowledge that her possession of that file was illegal speaks to the knowledge of his wrongfulness of that conduct, which plays into the consciousness of guilt issue.
Maybe I missed this in the record, but I thought that she just described to him what was in the file. He didn't actually read the file himself, did he?
No, he did not read the file, but what did occur was a conversation between Love and Tamlin in which she said, Mr. Barber told me this is highly inappropriate for me to have this file. And then he responded to her with that knowledge of her wrongfulness of having the file by saying, make sure that you make copies of it. And then the facts developed from there over the course of a number of phone conversations where he instructed her to hide witnesses. So his knowledge of the illegality of what she was doing, from her possession of the file to her use of the file, and then as the dominoes fall to hiding witnesses, was a critical component of the consciousness of guilt.
Is there any indication in any of those telephone conversations that he understood that it was his attorney who had done something improper, and therefore, effectively, to the extent that he was threatening her with the illegality of her possession, he was potentially raising a conflict with his attorney for having provided something improperly?
There is that indication in the record, Your Honor. In fact, there are a couple of notes from those recorded conversations. These are all found in volume 22 of the reporter's record, in which he says he's planning on firing Mr. Barber because of some of the issues that arose from the delivery of the file to Tamlin. And one point that I want to make sure I make is that the reason that the illegality of the file was important and why Mr. Barber was an expected sworn or unsworn witness on that issue is this, that once the jury found out, as Love promised that the jury would, that Tamlin had illegally possessed and used the file, the elephant in the courtroom would have been, who gave it to her? How did she get the illegal possession of this file? And she was a state's witness.
Could there not have been a stipulation? Could Mr. Barber have just said, I stipulate that I provided it to her and I shouldn't have?
Your Honor, I think there could have been that, but the problem with that is, and this answers another question that came up during the appellant's argument, before the disqualification matter arose, so between the time the state filed notice of the illegal discovery and the disqualification issue was litigated, Mr. Barber filed a motion to change venue out of Wichita County, and the argument was that the Wichita County citizens would be so prejudiced by knowledge of his illegality and discovery that his client wouldn't be able to get a fair trial in Wichita County. And so the trial court could have reasonably predicted that if and when this matter arose at trial, whether through sworn or unsworn testimony or through a stipulation, and the jury pool learned of that same fact, that Mr. Barber would again ask for extraordinary relief in form of a mistrial. That was no large leap for the trial court to make that conclusion.
Of course, that wasn't the sole reason for the change of venue motion, though.
Certainly not, but attached to that motion was a printout of a newspaper article that involved the allegation of that discovery violation. And then again at the hearing on the motion to change venue, Mr. Barber asked questions of witnesses regarding the public's knowledge of that discovery violation, and then gave an argument at the end of the hearing as that was one of the grounds that Mr. Love would not be able to receive a fair trial in Wichita County. And I think all of these issues are weighty, interesting issues, but I want to go back to a more fundamental issue, which was
so. Did any of the newspaper reporting with regard to the discovery violation actually come up during voir dire?
During
voir dire?
Voir dire, not to my knowledge, Your Honor, and I can go recheck the record on that.
Okay.
But I do want to emphasize that question leads me into another answer, which was that, or something else that I want to emphasize, which is that the trial court's determination of its ruling on disqualification is based on reasonableness. The touchstone of the abuse of discretion standard is reasonableness. The question before this court is not whether the trial court correctly predicted that this issue would arise at trial. The question is, was the trial court's ruling at the time that it made it, under the circumstances that were before the court at that time, reasonable? Not correct, but reasonable. And for the reasons in the state's brief, I think the ruling was reasonable. But again, I want to go back just briefly to the overarching issue that makes none of these questions necessary for disposition, and that is the state moved for disqualification on two independent grounds, Rule 3.08 and Rule 1.06. The 1.06 ground has not at all been challenged in this court through briefing. There was no reply brief filed. It hasn't been challenged again today in oral argument, and I would point this court to the court's Calton versus State opinion. It's a 2018 decision from this court in which the court said, if even one unchallenged independent ground fully supports the trial court's ruling, the appellate court must accept that unchallenged independent ground's validity, and any error in the appellant's challenged ground is harmless because the unchallenged independent ground remains to fully support the trial court's decision. Your Honor, the appellant's failure to challenge Rule 1.06, both in terms of citing the rule, discussing its legal concepts, applying it to the factual basis for disqualification that the state moved for under that rule, that failure in this court is fatal to his first issue. And for that reason alone, the court should overrule that issue and affirm the trial court's judgment on that issue. A couple of other questions that were asked in the appellant's argument that I would like to address. The argument was that this issue didn't arise in Blaine Brooks's trial, and so why would this case be any different? And the reason is Blaine Brooks didn't have the conversations with Tamlin Love that the appellant had. There's no recording of Blaine Brooks's conversations with with Tamalyn, in which they discussed the illegal nature of her possession of the file. So this case is simply factually distinguished from that case for that reason. Another argument that was made is, why couldn't the trial court have simply played the recordings? To avoid all of this issue, wouldn't that have been possible to play the recordings of the conversations between Tamalyn and Love? And the answer is no, because in those recordings, Tamalyn and Love discussed the illegality of her possession of the file. And so the issue would have been injected into the trial from the playing of those recordings.
Did they actually use the word illegality? I thought she said this is highly not proper. Did she go farther than that and say,
I don't know if she
illegal?
Used the word illegal, but certainly she did make the comment that Mr. Barber had told her that this was not allowed. And the knowledge, the collective knowledge of her and Love that it was illegal is demonstrated by the fact that he asked her, before giving the disc back to Mr. Barber, make sure that you go to your computer and make a copy of it. Certainly that demonstrates his knowledge of the illegality. And one last thing, if I may. The question was, well, what about the fact that this didn't arise at trial? That Barber was actually not called to testify at trial. And I've already given a partial response to that, but the other part of my response to that is that's exactly what happened in Gonzalez. In Gonzalez, if you go back and read the Court of Appeals' opinion in Gonzalez,
You can finish your sentence.
Okay. That in that case, the attorney Gonzalez also was not called to testify, and yet the Court of Appeals found that the disqualification ruling was not an abuse of discretion. The state asked the court to overrule the three issues and affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you, counsel.
Just to address the issue of the state's contention that there were multiple issues to brief here, I mean, the trial court entered a specific order that had findings of fact and conclusions of law, and that's what was challenged in this case, and that's what we challenged, and that's why, because that's what the court hung its hat on, and so.
But doesn't the order say Mr. Barber's actions have created a conflict between himself and his interests and those of the defendant?
It does, Your Honor, and I believe that's a predicate finding to go down and then say he's a likely witness means that it's 3.08 was the ground that the trial court was disqualifying him under. I think then the court even goes on to cite Gonzalez, which, of course, deals with 3.08, and so the specific order of the court addressed 3.08. So as far as the other arguments that may have been made, I believe that it was proper for us to just challenge based on that order.
Okay, whether the order did what it did or not, would you not agree that if Barber is at least in part filing a motion to transfer venue due to publicity in the area concerning his professional malfeasance, and that threatens his client's ability to get a fair trial because of his professional malfeasance, that would constitute a conflict between his professional and personal interests and the ability of his client to get a fair trial?
Whether or not there was a conflict between him and Justin Love is between him and Justin Love. If Justin Love wanted to go to trial with a lawyer that had a conflict and the other side wasn't harmed by it, then I think that he had every right to go that route. But to answer your question, arguably it's not helpful for the client-attorney relationship if something like that has come to light. That wasn't the sole grounds of asking for the change of venue. It was a very high-profile case. I mean, it was a murder. We don't have a lot of murders in Wichita County, fortunately. But it was a fairly high-profile case with lots of media attention, and there were multiple defendants. So that was one aspect of the attention that was raised. But, you know, if a lawyer messes up and it happens to make the news, you know, I don't know that it's fair to say there's always a conflict there.
Well, and Mr. Love wanted to keep Mr. Barber on as his retained counsel, did he not?
Yes. Yes, and as a matter of fact, on the record, it was raised again. It was unnecessary to raise it again, but it was raised again on the record right before they brought the jury in for voir dire, that Mr. Barber was still, that Love still wanted Mr. Barber as his attorney, and that's what he wanted. So, you know, that it was, and not to mention Love was at the hearing. I mean, he was well aware of what had gone on in the case and wanted to keep his lawyer.
And of course, that could have been to set up an appellate point, I suppose, but...
Well, yeah, and again...
Just theorizing.
Well, disqualifying an attorney sets up one, yes, and that's true. As far as the jail call, though, about Love, where Love said, we're going to ask you about the file, also I wanted to address just briefly, you know... there's really still no mention of Barber by anybody, though. There's no mention that Barber did something to facilitate me to do a bad deed here. Obviously, that came about, but we have to be very careful about what we're going to allow in terms of when are we going to disqualify lawyers. We have to be careful that we don't turn our rules of professional responsibility into some kind of a weapon to litigate with. When they're designed to protect the public, they're not there to give you an advantage and let you cut someone off at the knees a year before they go to trial by taking their lawyer away from them. And so that's why this case is dangerous. It is a dangerous case because it's affirming it could open the floodgates of all kinds of gamesmanship for using these rules to disqualify lawyers. And some of that already goes on, and it's an adversarial job, and some of that is going to go on, but this court has never head-on directed this kind of an issue like what you see in Gonzales, which is the same issue here. And so I would ask that the court reverse and remand this case. Also, in the event that you don't get to all of it...
Finish your sentence like I allowed opposing counsel
to. I do not
waive
any of the issues I brought up in the brief, so there are two other issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. It's a very useful oral argument, and your case is submitted.